Hello, everyone. Is this on still? Can you hear this everywhere? Brilliant. Welcome to the session about healthcare. And the first speaker is Garrett, talking about open pump and open medical devices. So thank you.
Hi. All right, so I want to tell you a little bit about open source hardware for medical devices and why I think it's a good idea. And I want to show you a project that I've been working on called Open Pump, of which you can see the first kind of iteration here on the screen. So let's start with something quite simple. This here is a hose clamp. You can download the design files off the internet. You can print it out on a 3D printer. And you can use it to block off a piece of tubing. So it's easy to see how something like this can be used in the medical environments where you maybe want to block off an IV a tube, or maybe you want to block off an infusion pump. And you can start to ask some interesting questions, like if something goes wrong, who's to blame? The person who designed it, the person who actually manufactured it in the sense of printing it out on a 3D printer, or the person that decided to use it in a hospital, for example. Now, maybe this will not happen in a UK hospital anytime soon, but what about the developing world, where it makes a lot more sense to have a 3D printer to print out your spare parts than trying to source your parts from somewhere remote? So let's move on to a little bit more complex example. This here is a peristaltic pump. It was designed as a fluid reward system for lab animals. But it's not difficult to imagine how this further iterations of a device like this could potentially be used in hospitals for administering medication. It has a little Raspberry Pi computer over here. It has a little reservoir over here and a little peristaltic pump, all integrated into or held together with a little open beam construction set platform. So what's nice about this is that little peristaltic pump motor there looks something like this. And you can buy it from an open source hardware distributor called Adafruit for around £17. You could even make your own. You can actually 3D print the peristaltic pump mechanism yourself, or you can make one that's a little bit more durable using a laser printer, laser cutter. The designs are available for all these. There are different kinds of designs available for peristaltic pump mechanisms. And this means that we can now make peristaltic pumps for 5 to 10% of the cost of what you will pay for a commercial pump. They run anywhere from £500 to £10,000. So you can start to come up with some interesting questions around these. And then on the most complex part of the spectrum, I would say, is something like this, that is an open source hardware CT scanner. It was designed by a guy called Peter Janssen, who's a postdoctoral researcher in Canada, and he's made this CT scanner. He's now working on an open source MRI scanner, and he originally designed it for academic and educational purposes. But it is his hope that this could one day be used in impoverished countries where they don't already have access to CT scanners. At the moment, it doesn't work that well. This is a scan that it took from a bell pepper, where you can just make out the seed pod over here. The reason for the resolution being so low is that he's using a very low radiation source that you can still legally get without having to without too much trouble. Because he wants anyone to be able to build their own. He's currently working on version 2, which should improve how long it takes to acquire the image. An image like this still takes around 3 to 4 hours to acquire. So he's building a second version where it uses multiple sensors to acquire the data a little bit quicker. All right, so that's some examples of existing projects that may turn into medical devices one day. There's a specific problem that I want to focus on, and I want to explain a little bit about why I'm focusing on this problem. This here is a photo of a pediatric intensive care unit. There is a baby over here, and there is a whole bank of infusion devices that's attached to the child. You've got a peristaltic pump here at the bottom, you've got various syringe pumps here at the top, and they're all connected to the baby to provide medication over a set period of time. Now, one thing you'll notice on here is that there are a couple of post-it notes that are attached to these devices, which to me indicate that there is a clear design flaw or failure of design, in that these devices need to be modified by the clinicians in order to properly use them. What is going to happen if one of those post-it notes fall down, and how is that going to affect the care to the patient? Around 17% of all deaths in the Western world can be attributed to hospital-related error. If it were considered to be a disease, it would actually be the third biggest killer, right behind heart disease and cancer. More than half of these hospital-related errors are due to some form of use error, so that's somebody using the device in the wrong way, or making a mistake, either using the software or the design of the device itself. So it seems that current standards and regulations do not seem to have the desired effect. So I've been working on a research project together with a couple of other people over the past 5 or 6 years on a research project to improve the safety of interactive medical devices. And as part of that, I started thinking, you know what? What if we try to follow an open source development approach for infusion devices? And I came up with what I call Open Pump, which is open source syringe pump. So let me first explain by saying why I think open source hardware is a good idea and why I think this is a possible solution to the problem. Well, first of all, anyone can contribute and help to improve the design. So you can basically set a reference platform there. It still allows for manufacturers and people to differentiate themselves in other ways, but you try to make sure that the reference platform that is set there is safe and reliable. Once you have this platform, you can modify design for specific use cases. So if you have a pediatric intensive care unit, or you want to make an ambulatory device that you can put into a hospital, into a helicopter, you can modify the design for your specific use case. We can start to prevent vendor lock-in. It seems that the case with most infusion pumps at the moment is that they tend to follow the inkjet printer business model, where the devices are sold at very low cost, and then you're locked in using to that vendor's consumables. We can also, by using open source hardware, increase the safety, security, and robustness by allowing anyone to inspect and improve the designs. Sure, it's not fail-proof. We've seen with things like the OpenSSL heartbleed bug and so on, that even with open source device, open source software, things are not always completely safe and secure. But at least when we have access to the software and the designs, we can see the problems that are there. I think the problem is much worse in closed source environments. And of course, once the problem has been identified, if it is, if you're using an open source hardware device, it becomes a lot easier to fix these problems yourself. And then, of course, if we have such an open source design, it allows manufacturers to compete on other areas. So they can compete on things like usability, support, and interoperability, instead of trying to, I don't know, patent some kind of safety feature that they only then sell with their specific device. And there's one last thing, and that is, of course, it has a lot of applications in the developing world. We know that donated medical devices don't work. In a World Health Organization report, it showed that 70 to 90% of all donated medical devices don't work as intended. 25% of these devices don't work because of issues like poor training or user manuals that are not available. This is an issue that is more often solved in open source, where you have access to the documentation and it's available online. And then the other issue of around 15% of these devices actually fail for very simple reasons. That could be something like a broken fuse or a dead battery. If you have access to the design files, you can. It's a lot easier for you to go and see what's wrong with the device and how you can fix it yourself. Right, so this is the kind of first prototype that I started off with Open Pump. At the top there, you can see the mechanical design that was created by a group at Michigan Tech University, where they already did the reliability tests and so on the mechanical design itself. I then went on and designed a circuit so that I could plug it into an Arduino microcontroller I had a little touchscreen, color touchscreen to attach to it, as well as a dual concentric rotary encoder so that you can easily set the rate of milliliters per hour for the syringe pump. I then went off and designed a little circuit board so that everything could just plug into that. This circuit board plugs into the Arduino microcontroller, and you have a solution where you don't need to solder anything. You can just plug all the components and get going that way. And then I went off and designed a little 3D printed enclosure so that you can put all your electronics and everything inside a little box. Here at the bottom, which is maybe a little bit difficult to see on this projector, is the various iterations that I went through to make sure that everything fits nicely inside the box. And I ended up with the current iteration, which looks like this. It's obviously still very early days. I don't think this is something that you'll use in a hospital, but it is already being used in DIY bio and biotech labs. London Biohackspace has one, as these things have other applications outside of healthcare as well. Right, so how did I go about making this? Well, there's a tool called OpenSCAD. It looks a little bit like this. It allows you to create 3D models and then send them to your 3D printer. It's a tool that is quite easy to use for programmers, being that you actually create your 3D model as a script, and you then compile your scripts into the 3D model over here. The reason why that's really nice is, well, that part over there was designed by Michigan Tech. I realized that the syringe I was using had a different diameter. I changed a single variable in the code, recompiled it, printed out some new 3D parts, and I could use that part with my specific syringe. This here is Fritzing. It's another open source tool. This one is designed for electronic circuit board design. What's really nice about this tool is it has different views. So there at the top, you can see the different tabs. You have the breadboard view, schematic, and PC, the printed circuit board view. The breadboard view looks like a little bit like this. So you can see how I went from that first prototype that I built, basically just plunked down all the components, drew all the wires in, and from there it generated the schematic view, and from there I could then create the circuit board view. Once I had the circuit board, I clicked on the fabricate button, it gets sent off to a fab. I actually used a local fab in the UK called Ragworm. They sent back the circuit board itself in the mail a week later, and it cost around £10 to make the circuit board. This here is the Arduino development environment. So to write the code for the pump, you write everything in Arduino code, which is kind of like a variant of the C programming language, quite easy to develop for and to actually create embedded code that runs on the pump itself. So the team in Michigan Tech actually published a paper recently where they tried to quantify the value of open source hardware. And they came up with this equation over here, where it basically says where CP is the cost of the traditional product, CF is the marginal cost of digital fabrication, P over there is the percentage of downloads that resulted in a product being made, and ND over there is the actual number of downloads that they had. And they did a calculation for the syringe pump design, the original design that my open pump is based on, and they calculated that they already had savings of between $778,000 and $12.4 million over the course of 1 year. Right, so what are some of the challenges of open source hardware? Well, first of all, certification is time-consuming and expensive. It takes a long time, a lot of money to run clinical trials and to get your device certified. And of course, there is also the issue of liability that I already hinted at earlier. Who is to blame if things go wrong? What if you're just an open source project trying to make these things? Who is going to support it? I don't think these are unsolvable issues. They just need some thought and some coordination. And then one other thing is incompatibility with traditional standards. So the existing medical device standards prescribe a specific development methodology and development models to follow when you create medical devices. They are a bit incompatible with the way that open source development is done. To give you an example, with medical device regulation standards, at a certain stage you need to freeze your design, you then apply for certification, and your design is not allowed to change afterwards. You are allowed to make safety and security updates, but you should prove that your device is still equivalent to what was certified. Otherwise, you would have to reapply for certification. So that is something that is potentially doesn't work that well with the way that open source development works. Again, I don't think it's an unsolvable problem, but it is going to require some thought. Then, if you would like to get involved with some of these projects, OpenPump is at openpump.org. There's also Open Healthcare UK's Open Spirometer project. They're here as well today. I think they're giving the next presentation. So a spirometer is a device that measures your breathing rate. I think they're using an ultrasonic flow sensor to do this. You can have a look at openspirometer.org. And then there's the Night Scout project, part of the We Are Not Waiting movement. And this is a project for getting glucometer readings for diabetics, where the reason why it's called We Are Not Waiting is that they didn't want to wait for traditional manufacturers to create the platforms necessary for them to get hold of their own data. So they developed both the software and hardware to get glucometer data and visualize it on the web, on their mobile phones, and on smartwatches. And you can have a look at Night Scout at nightscout.info. Great. So, thanks. And I think we have a couple of minutes of questions.
Yeah, we've got time for like one question, and maybe if David wants to plug his computer in while we're here. Has anyone got a good question? Apart from the next speaker, but you can ask. Anyone else? Yeah, go for it.
So you said that it's a tractable problem to reduce the barrier to entry for certification for open source hardware products. With some thought, could you elaborate on those thoughts?
So I think one of the largest barriers at this moment is money. I suppose if you're an open source project, you could try the crowdfunding approach. I don't know if anybody's, I don't think anybody's done that yet. But I suppose that's the biggest barrier at the moment. I know the Night Scout project have been working with the FDA in the US to try and see how to get the open source development model closer to what needs to be certified by the FDA. And they're making good progress there. So, yeah, the future looks good.
Fantastic. Thanks, Garrett.
So, moving very, very smoothly on from the last slides, the last one, I'm David, and I work for Open Healthcare. And we try and make digital work for the NHS and for healthcare. At the minute, by default, digital in the NHS is essentially universally broken. We had some examples of that a couple of talks ago, in terms of you can hack into sites kind of broken. It's also breaking a whole bunch of other ways. The services that we have in the NHS really aren't as good as the services that we now expect from government and the state. We haven't caught up with the transformation agenda. As a professional, it's often even worse working in hospitals. The software that you're forced to use is really kind of incredibly bad. Every time I look at it, never ceases to shock me. And this is kind of a problem because we know how to build high quality digital services as a society, but we're kind of failing to do this catastrophically for the NHS, which is a huge opportunity cost. It's quite an important thing to get right. In our hospital, the basic user need is, as a doctor, I want to kind of understand what's wrong with this person. That's the first thing you need to solve. And we don't even do that very well at the minute. We have lots of systems fragmentation. The information is often within the institution, but it won't be on one screen. It'll be shared across all kinds of different places. It'll be on bits of paper in someone's back pocket. It'll be on charts at the end of the bed. When it is digitized, like I said, the usability is often really, really kind of shocking. And that ends up with people not bothering to record things, recording things badly, forgetting where to look for stuff. And this is quite bad when you're in most settings, but in a hospital setting, the information being incorrect or not being able to find it has really severe consequences, like death, for instance, which is something we try and avoid. And this is part of what we're talking about, the huge incidence of avoidable deaths in hospitals. So the question that we ask open healthcare, is how do we do better than this? And essentially our theory is that there's three ways that you need to attack a problem. First up, you show frontline staff how good digital can be and empower them to demand better. You make sure that highly usable clinical digital services that actually meet user needs are a thing that's available to the NHS. And you encourage policymakers to remove the structural and cultural barriers that create an environment for innovation. But that's a nice theory. But the next question is, how do we actually do this in practice? And that's essentially what we're going to talk about today. At the very kind of low level, trying to build a community and trying to encourage people to figure out how digital can be better, we run a thing called NHS Hack Day, which started out in possibly this very room about 4 years ago, where we run weekend events for doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals and patients. And we get them together with doctors and designers. We do a hack day, I think. And the value of that is that you have people coming with real user needs, and they get to see inside how software development works. And they get to see that this stuff is not magic, and it's possible to do good things. And we kind of showcase the value of working directly with software developers. You show them that actually it is possible to have things which are quite nice, even for your day-to-day problems, and kind of avoid people being institutionalized into thinking it's impossible to have anything better than the current status quo. So the next bit is just making sure that there is something better that's available to people, which is where a lot of the work that we do at Open Healthcare actually focuses around just providing something that is better and is available. So essentially what you have to do is provide digital products and services. So what I thought we would do today to focus on today would be to talk about, in the context of providing digital products and services to the NHS which actually meet user needs, what are the problems, what are the frustrations, what are the barriers, and how do we actually get past them? And so the very, very starting point is that the systems which go into hospitals in general are not procured by or designed by people who actually use them. And that creates this gap in the market where the systems don't meet the needs of people who actually need to use them. And this is relatively simple because you just do the software development thing where you find out what people's user needs are and you spend time with them and you talk to them. And that's a thing that you can actually solve relatively easily by doing that. And the value for hospitals is quite clear. What you want is you want your doctors to deliver better care, to spend less time fighting with computer systems, more time with patients, and that's quite obvious. But actually trying to bring those processes into the NHS is quite hard, because there's all these barriers to the pace of change. We have long-term contracts with proprietary vendors, which become slow and expensive to iterate, which become slow and expensive to switch to different vendors. And you have lots of these very, very large software projects, and what we know about very large software projects is that they fail at the same rate as small software projects, but it's much more expensive, and you lose a lot of opportunities. But as well as the kind of structural, contractual ways this happens, there's a cultural element to it, right? So at, you know, very large, modern, leading-edge hospitals with large research centres, in walking distance from here, if you're a strong walker. So we hear stories like, we are having a global institutional code freeze for 2 years because we're changing hosting provider. And that's kind of not really good enough in 2015. But the fact that someone proposed that as a strategy and it was accepted is about the culture of accepting that change is kind of hard. It's going to take that long, just being a thing that you can accept. Within the NHS, there remains the culture that we have seen in the past, in kind of the public sector more generally, of defaulting to off-the-shelf products, to outsourcing, to long-term contracts, and when you do have people building in-house and custom building things, what you have is one organization that's publicly funded, building something themselves, and then looking to sell it for profit to another publicly funded organization and not sharing. The culture of kind of coding in the open hasn't really reached it. So the way that you kind of get around this is to own a lot more of your own services, by which I mean have the opportunity to make changes, have it within your power to change things at your own pace and not be at the behest of other vendors. Ideally, kind of working for a hospital in the NHS as, let's say, a programmer should be a really exciting thing. It should be quite a sexy job. In practice, it's an incredibly boring job, and it's quite frustrating, and you have limited autonomy, and you tend to be paid below market rates, and it's not a very nice place. That's a problem. Given that that's where we are, the next best thing that we can do is we can encourage hospitals to start to run more digital teams, more modern teams, and if you can't quite get to that transition at the start, the next best thing is to work with SMEs on open source, because you can transition those things later. So this set of things where we have slow change leads to a lack of feedback loops, because if you're going to have no change within any system at your hospital for 2 years, and you're there for 1.5 years, there's no incentive for you to report any kind of failure or any kind of problem. And the lack of feedback loops means that you end up with a situation where, for doctors on the front line, the places where they can innovate in the way that they store information, transfer information between them, the way they use data, tends to end up being paper. So it's trees and Microsoft Word. And that means, that's not, again, not really acceptable in 2015, that you can't have services that support that kind of innovation. Now, the way that we kind of address that is to allow things to be out in the open. If you have open source projects with genuine open governance, then people can see what's going on. You can track, I reported this issue, this is where it's being prioritized, these are the people who've been assigned to it, this is what we think, this is when it's going to go. And that all flows through. At a slightly higher level, the NHS is not a nice environment to do innovative digital services in. And honestly, we have got no idea how to really fix that. What I'm talking about here is stuff like the economics of the cloud and allowing people to have kind of zero marginal cost supply services just hasn't arrived in the NHS, and that's a mixture of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about regulation and governments, and institutional monopolies having no incentive to change, and some kind of interesting contractual agreements which weren't particularly far-sighted that we're now unable to get out of. Beyond that, the digital transformation within the NHS is kind of quite a long way back at the really bare bones level, by which I mean the room where you work in should have a connection to the network. Otherwise, it's quite expensive and hard to provide you with digital services. And when you do connect to the network, the computer you connect to the network on should have a web browser, which is relatively recent. Otherwise, it's quite slow and hard and expensive to provide you with high quality digital services. So what we've ended up with in our attempt to find ways to deal with this is this thing called OPAL, which is our framework for building clinical applications, which is an open source framework built on modern web technologies. And there's a number of applications built on this, which are running in the NHS today in hospitals. Very nearly, just across the way. And what we've done with this is we have a whole set of tools for common problems that occur within when you're writing clinical applications. And they've all been extensively user tested. And we've gone around at the hack days that we run, and we've proved that you can get from a kind of plausible user needs to a plausible minimum viable product over the course of a hack day repeatedly. And that ends up with the starting ground and the building blocks for providing these kind of services to the NHS. So, moving on to the third level, we have... What we want to do is find a way to encourage policymakers to make it easier to bring high-quality digital to the engine. And so we're going to run through some ideas for things that would make policies that would make things better. So at the start, we have open standards within healthcare. We have some relatively good standards, and we have some relatively open standards, but we also have lots of places where they're not really used. So this is a very simple... The policy would be that all systems, all new systems, have to use open standards, and all legacy systems have to be transferred to use open standards by year X. And at the same time, you would encourage people to code in the open and provide incentives for doing that. The digital transformation agenda is the thing that I was talking about before. It makes sure there's Wi-Fi across the NHS estate. It makes sure there's a web browser that's not completely very, very old on every computer that you use. Service assessments, hospitals. The government digital service has a standard for designing new services, and what they do when they launch a new service is they assess the thing that you've done against that standard. There's no reason why a very, very similar mechanism couldn't be used for new services which are brought into hospitals. And at policy level, you can, even with the distributed procurement and decision-making within the NHS, you could throw a pot of money and say, we will match fund you if you do your software development this way. And that way you kind of bring your global way to do digital well and bring it down to the hospital level. So what all these kind of add up to is a way to get to a place where the software that you use at work should be at least as good as the software that you use at home. And that's kind of the basic, that should be allowed, and that should be the place where we want to get at. What can you do to help with that? You can come to an NHS Hack Day. You can come and help people. You can help show people how good digital can be, and how digital can meet people's needs. If you have the skills and it's within your gift, then we have genuine open source projects which are in use within the NHS. You can contribute to those. You can help with the policy conversations that we're starting to have with these ideas. How do we get those implemented? Are they even the right ideas? Those are the things that we have. That's open healthcare. Are there any questions?
You mentioned that there's... So you mentioned there's some open source NHS software projects. Could you give us some examples of some of them?
Yeah. So, as a couple, so there is one that we run at, let's say, UCLH, which is a thing called the Electronic Clinical Infection Database, which lets you manage patients, inpatients and outpatients with infections. That's a thing that's in use. There's a thing called OpenEyes, which is not by me. There are other people doing good things in the NHS. It's run by a lovely guy called Bill, who works at Moorfields down the road, and it's the thing if you're into eyes. If you want to do some eye doctoring, this is the thing you use for it. And they're both on GitHub, for instance.
Right to the back. Does this one work?
Has there been any open source work with regards to more frontline services, so ambulance and first responders as opposed to hospitals?
Not to my knowledge. There is very, very limited genuine open source in the NHS. The direction of travel is improving. There's better support from a high level at the centre, but there's very, very little. I've not heard anything in that space.
Oh my god, you have to be this close, it's like making out with a microphone. Anyway. Just get other people's mouths to be close to infection and talking about healthcare. What I want to know is who can help bring about this cultural shift that is clearly needed within healthcare? You know, can I do something? Is it just doctors? Like, is it policy people? Who should be how can we make this go faster?
So there's a couple of steps. So at the ground level, there is a community ground up kind of way of doing this. So you have people who work within institutions can create a demand for better and say this is not good enough and say no and say we know that things can be better. And that's a lot of what the community building aspects of Edge is hacked to do. At the other end, there are some things that can only be done by policymakers, essentially. And those people, I mean, I don't know who they are. Generally, they don't answer my phone calls. But the ones who I think it might be don't take my calls. So it's tough to know. But there are things which have to be done at a kind of systemic level to solve some of these. I can't individually decide to put a Wi-Fi network into a hospital, even if I really, really want to and I know how to.
One more question.
Kind of
general one
about money. What's the nature of money in your
organisation? Are you getting charitable
funding? Are you successfully selling open source
into the NHS? Are you not doing without any money at all? What's the situation? So the nature of money in our organisation is there's not enough of it. But we provide services to hospitals. We provide support, maintenance, development and that stuff. We're a limited liability company. It's all funded through people procuring services from us.
Thanks, David. That's fantastic. And our final speaker, we move from healthcare into research, and it's Joseph MacArthur from Open Access Research. This is about not just sharing academic papers, but sharing, I think, the source code behind the research as well, and how that works.
Okay, great, this is working. I totally felt your talk, David. You've gone somewhere, I can't see you anymore. I've been trying to get an electronic prescription working for like 6 months now. Can't do it. It's driving me nuts. So great introduction, thank you. I'm basically going to talk about open access to research and also then kind of talk about the code behind research a little bit as well. I'm used to talking to people who know kind of tons and tons about research, about how academia works and things like that. So just flag me if I get confusing at any point, but I'll try and make sure it all makes sense on the way. Very briefly, you can find my slides for this talk at the end. The link will be repeated at the end as well. And as my day job, I suppose, I do work with students and graduates and early career researchers on this issue and talking about getting access to research. And so just to take a few steps back, most of the healthcare innovations that we have, most of the progress we've made, you know, as a society over the past kind of 100 years or so, just throwing out kind of any old number there, has had its roots grounded a lot of the time in scientific innovation, in figuring out how stuff ticks and then finding out ways to make that tick in ways that we like. And at the basis of all of that, the way the academic community works is essentially by publishing peer-reviewed findings in academic journals. And so you have a journal for fish research, and essentially all the research on fish goes into that journal. Essentially everyone interested in that research about fish will look at that journal. That's slightly oversimplified, but that's more or less how it works. All of the stuff that's inside of that journal will have been put there after it's been reviewed by other scientists. So I can't publish into the peer-reviewed kind of scientific literature without other people looking at it first. And as part of that, I have to detail kind of an introduction to my area, what I did exactly, what the results I got were, and then I'll discuss them and try and make some conclusions. And then that's kind of seen as the unit of research, right? And so many people who are kind of looking at this research will be very familiar with this feeling, the feeling of not being able to access this research because of what's called a paywall. If people are familiar with the term paywall, just stick your hands up for me. That would be a really useful gauge. Oh, cool. I've completely patronized you all. I'm so sorry. So essentially, you'll probably be familiar with this feeling of finding that piece of research that you need and then hitting that paywall and going, okay, right, I'm being asked to pay $35, £25 for something. I don't even know what that thing is yet. I haven't paid for it. I can't read it. And a lot of the times, you're shown only just kind of a paragraph of information and asked to pay a huge amount of money for that. And it's absolutely insane. for me, this became a problem 2 or 3 years ago when I was working for the pharmaceutical industry, where you would think they would have access to all this stuff anyway, but they don't. Suddenly started to get extremely frustrated, but I never thought to look behind these paywalls, I guess, to find out why they're there, and that's what I'm going to kind of tell you about very briefly. So it turns out that those journals, that FISH journal, can cost anywhere from kind of $1,000 or pounds per year per institution, and that to get proper coverage of a field, you'll sometimes need a dozen, sometimes 100 different journals covering different areas. And if you're in a large institution like the one we're in now, or UCL, which is down the road, you're subscribing to thousands of these journals. And that cost really starts to rack up very, very quickly until you're in the millions of pounds per year for a big institution. Now, the problem with this is that amount of prices, that amount has been going up year upon year upon year above inflation at kind of an increasing rate. So the important line here is essentially the red line, which shows that in the past 30 years, the prices for these journals have gone up over 400%. And this is in an era where we've seen the cost of distribution of these materials go down substantially. They're much, much, much less do we see print journals being made, things being literally printed and shipped to people's offices. Nowadays, it's all done with this magical thing called the internet. And yet somehow, this increase in price has been justified time and time again. And this is what has led people like The Economist to say things along the lines of, publishing obscure academic journals is that rare thing in the media industry, a license to print money. This has all happened in the context of DVDs and music all being kind of revolutionized, and yet this form of information has not seen that in any kind of way. And so it's unsurprising that the companies that publish this, the obscure academic journal publishers, make huge amounts of money and huge profit margins. Again, the important thing on here is the essentially the red bars, and it shows the profit margin for these companies. And actually, these figures are continuing to go up, and I could kind of give you an even grander number for a lot of these. This graph tends to essentially contrast them against the big tech companies. So you can see Google, Microsoft, Apple there. And the big academic publishers are rivaling them. So this makes much, much, much less when you understand the kind of nuts and bolts of how the academic publishing system works. Essentially, I, as an author, want to publish my work. That's essentially how I'm evaluated as an author, and that has its own problems, but let's ignore them for now. So I want to get my work out to the world. So I look at that FISH journal and I say, I want to publish with you. And the FISH journal says, great, that's fantastic. And I then, as an author, give my work to them for free. And they go out and from big lists and say, okay, who else is working in this area? Who has the expertise to look at this paper and say, is it good? Is it bad? Kind of give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. That's kind of essentially the peer review process in a nutshell. And the FISH journal gives it to those peer reviewers. You look at it for free, send it back to the journal with reviews or comments, or just says, yeah, that's good to publish. And then the journal finally bundles it up along with lots of other papers which have been through this process and sells it back to that same author again. And there are lots of cases, almost comically, but not quite so, where authors buy back their own work from the publishers a few months after they've given it to them for essentially huge amounts of money. And scientists are willing to put up with this because, one, they're not paid for publishing. They just have a wage, and they publish as much as they can as part of that. But also, it's a huge monopoly. There is essentially no alternative to the system, so you're forced into it if you want to do this kind of stuff. We, as the public, should be essentially outraged because 80% of this research is publicly funded. So We're paying to create this scientific research, this research in the humanities or even in the social sciences. We're paying for that to be made, and then we have to buy it back from these big private companies. So we end up paying for it 2, 3, 4 times over. Essentially, we pay for it every time a university buys a subscription. And there are a lot of universities, so we end up paying for this research. And this isn't inflammatory, hundreds of times, from the time that we've made it to the time we've bought it back 150 times for the different universities. So, that's kind of the background to why we need things like open access. But what actually is open access? About 15 years ago, when the internet started becoming, you know, super, super cool, a lot of people said, we can use this to revolutionize the journal publishing industry. And they came up with this idea of open access, which is free immediate online access to scholarly articles with full reuse rights. And what this means is that rather than being asked for £30 every time, it's just published for free. The cost of publishing those articles is paid for in different ways. Sometimes that's by having the publishing the research being seen as part of the cost of doing the research, and so it's paid by the research funder. Sometimes it's paid by other means. Charities will set up journals to publish work they're interested in. Funders will set up journals to do the same kind of thing. Sometimes it's sponsorship or advertisement. You know, essentially uses all of the business models that make the rest of the internet tick. And this has been actually really, really quite successful. It's been a long fight, and it's been... but we're getting there, and now we're looking at a place where there is kind of around 10% of the literature is published open access. And that's doesn't sound like much for 10 or 15 years work, but we are really starting to see some progress in this area. And it's fantastic to see. And many people would say that we're kind of at a tipping point in the culture between the old system and the new system. And we've been supported by policymakers, academics, lobbyists, librarians, kind of all these sorts of things. And that's kind of a very quick crash course in open access. But now I kind of want to talk about code, and code as a research object, and code as a tool for getting stuff done. But before I do that, I did just want to say that open in science and open source are actually subtly different things, although they're important differences. Often when we talk about open in science, we talk about licenses like CC BY and the Creative Commons licenses. Whereas open source, there's the kind of the whole other framework, and the one I always think about is the MIT license. And often there are equivalents, but there's a difference that I always tend to try and remember, which is that often open source code is open in science doesn't tend to be share alike. So you can essentially do whatever you want with something once it's been made CC BY, whereas with some of the open source licenses, it has to be made, has to be kept open. So it's a subtle difference in the way we talk about open, and there's a whole discussion to be had about that. But I won't go properly into it, I just want to make people aware. So when we talk about code, I simplified how we can talk about it into two very, very simple headers. Code as science, so code as a research object, and code for science. Code is a way of providing tools to do the research. So a quick idea of code as a research object, it's part of a larger idea known as open science. So open access covers the idea that that the article should be made freely available. Open science says, wait, hold on, there's also the data, the code, the lab equipment, the consumables that we use, and all of that it should be made openly available. All of that was, under many of the same arguments, paid for by public money, and it should be made openly available for others to reuse. And a lot of people see sharing code as essential for... So sharing code is important for reproducibility, essentially. Where was I? It says on the slide. That's quite a segue. Sharing code is essential, reproducibility, and right now not a lot of code is being shared at all, and the code that's being produced for research is often awful. And this has led to a whole host of problems with reproducibility inside the literature, which I think people have in the depths of their heart known about for a long time, but are now starting to hit the headlines. I chose just the first few that came to my mind as the kind of different studies and different initiatives that are looking at this kind of thing. But essentially, it's not very, very good. And for research literature that we should be able to trust and that we make healthcare decisions on, we make decisions on how to organize our society, we make, almost a huge number of decisions, at least, when we're trying to make evidence-based ones, are based on this literature, it's key that it's reproduced, or at least reproducible. And a huge number of the cases aren't. But there is kind of a different side as well, which says that not only is code sharing code great for reproducibility, but it's also important for just getting better results in the first place. There's this set of challenges, which I've forgotten the name of, but I mean, inside this link, they'll be there somewhere, which basically encouraged a bunch of labs to come together and say, okay, we have a data set here, and we want to use it to predict, thank you, predict outcomes in breast cancer survival. And essentially, we're going to ask you guys to compete to make increasingly good code sets, essentially algorithms and stuff like that, which from this data set will predict the eventual outcome. So they went in with about a 50% prediction rate, or you know, that you could trust. And essentially, by the time that the challenge had got people to try and work together, they'd encouraged code sharing by providing kind of $500 prizes if you use someone else's code and if someone else used your code. And they managed to increase the accuracy of the model from 50 to 75% prediction, which is, you know, that goes from about 50-50 coin flip to actually something which may be useful clinically. And that's the kind of effects that you can see when you share code. So more and more initiatives are starting up to look at this, and it's kind of fantastic to see. We're seeing even people like Nature take view of this, and big NGOs like Mozilla, who are starting to look at this and put really serious time and effort into finding a way for academics to work around code. These are not the only things that I could have mentioned. So the second way to think about code is using code actually, you know, to design tools. Everyone in the world at the moment is trying to design Uber for X, and that's no different. People are trying to think about, you know, Uber for science almost constantly. And there are actually some existing platforms out there. You know, when we're looking at platforms and Uber for this, you know, we can all think about Airbnb and literally Uber, Facebook, etc. But there's ones that in science we more identify with, like, for example, Creative Commons, and I can play the same Lego game with initiatives in science as well. Everything from Wikipedia to CCAN to Sage to PLOS are examples of open multi-sided platforms.
Oh, it's just the
CCAN. Oh, yeah. I was like, two questions or... So these are all great initiatives. The problem is that there are literally hundreds of different platforms and different projects. And I definitely can't put all of those around the open multi-sided platform or even just open mark. And in fact, a lot of people are extremely worried at the moment about essentially having essentially completely proprietary... lost it. Completely proprietary workflows between an idea and publishing, whereby essentially you can't pull out anything from that process, and potentially none of it is reusable or open. And that's kind of seen as a big problem. This is kind of the plug section of the talk where I talk about a thing I'm doing, but essentially, you know, one of the things that we've been building is called the Open Access Button. And it is one of these, thankfully, open tools, which looks to tackle essentially the first problem that I essentially presented, which is that people can't access the literature because it's behind paywalls. And essentially what we look to do is track when and where people aren't able to access research and tell stories about those people. So what, you know, what papers are they... is a certain patient looking at, what papers are doctors not being able to access to treat people, what studies are students using to try and learn that they can't access, and we try and tell kind of really interesting, intricate stories about people and essentially reach out to authors in a novel way to try and get them to publish open access. And I know I don't have a huge amount of time, so I'm just going to spring past a bit. Essentially, my end point, that's good timing, is that science needs more open tools, which means that science needs
more open developers.
And if you want a gateway drug, I would love to suggest that the open access button also needs more open developers, and that you can do that in all of these places. And so I will leave it at that, except if we have time for questions.
Not really.
Not really. Cool.
Thank you. Thank you, Joseph.